In the story of London, I have often told tales of famous crimes, and especially famous crimes involving royalty, be it King Canute stealing the bones of St. Elphege from St. Paul's Cathedral, as recovered back in chapter 36, or the two-part saga of the robbery of the crown jewels of King Edward I, which we covered in chapters 109 and 110, I like to describe crime involving the royal family in London. And this episode covers one of those tales, a little-known story of criminality and smuggling taking place towards the end of the reign of the first Tudor king. But what makes it especially interesting is that this time, the king appears to have been at the heart of it all. And yet, in telling the story of this crime, we have to understand the context of stuff going on around it, as this incredible act of illegality was part and parcel of what was going on in Europe, and how from London, Henry VII is able to spin a web of criminality and shadows that allowed him to become a crucial figure in the great European geopolitical battle of its age. So, welcome to a story of high politics, secret deals, spurned princesses, shipwrecks, nepotism, and a hell of a lot more. Let us slide into one of the most overlooked periods of London's story, as we explore part one of a sequence of events I have somewhat unoriginally entitled The Spanish Gambit. In August 1504, a resident of London dragged his weary and poorly self back to home after a rather difficult visit to Rome. His name was Robert Sherborne, and he held the position in London as the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral. Now, Robert had just had a very taxing homeward journey. He had travelled from the Holy City north. He had reached the Alps, then, after navigating harsh mountain passes, had found himself traversing along the waterways of the Rhine, heading north, ending up in the Netherlands, and then, after arranging shipping, he'd crossed the Channel. This journey had taken a lot out of him. He was in actually very poor health. But what was worse, he was returning with bad news. The Pope Julius II had failed to issue a papal bull regarding the permission for Prince Henry of England to marry Catherine of Aragon, and he had nominated the Dean of St. Paul's to return to England to bring Henry VII the news. Henry VII was rightfully annoyed. He'd just donated £4,000 to the Pope, nominally to help with a crusade somewhere, but you know, it was a bribe, and he had gained nothing for his cash. Ironically, a bull had been issued about this marriage, but Julius II had not told Dean Sherborne. What neither he nor King Henry VII knew at the time was that the Pope had issued a bull to the Spanish kingdoms, quote, under seal of secrecy, unquote. It was received by the gravely poorly Queen Isabella of Castilla, Catherine of Aragon's mother. But to her horror, the document from the Pope contradicted what Catherine of Aragon's duenna, Donna Elvira, had told her in writing. This bull clearly stated that her daughter's previous marriage to Prince Arthur had been consummated. Catherine, it proclaimed loud and clear on its very first line, was no virgin. And this was an expensive problem because, simply put, Queen Isabella and her husband King Ferdinand of Aragon had already paid a fortune and a dowry to the King of England to marry their virgin daughter to his eldest son Prince Arthur. But now to marry his brother after Prince Arthur died, well, she was no longer a virgin, and that meant there was an additional payment of 100,000 scudos to be given in order for Henry VII to agree to this union. If she wasn't a virgin, the money belonged to the English king. The Spanish king and queen, in response to this early draft, began pulling strings behind the scenes. When the final draft of this papal bull was released a time later, there was a small but highly significant alteration, presumably caused by Spanish pressure, inserted into the opening sentence of the document, which stated that Catherine had contracted a marriage with Prince Arthur, quote, and that this marriage had been consummated, unquote. The Pope now added a single word, forsan, aka perhaps. Now, Julius had come up with this phrasing in a way to, he hoped, appease the English and the Spanish. And then, after he did it, he washed his hands of everything. In the event that single word satisfied neither Henry VII nor King Ferdinand. And it has to be said that 25 years into the future, the ambiguity of this opening sentence was going to have a hell of an impact upon the future of London. But the little moment where we saw the Dean of St. Paul's travelling to Rome and back again to convey messages showed he was part of a pan-European network of politics and messages that were going from London to Aragon to Italy and took in all the lands in between. And this denotes a period in time where London was finding itself, not only, as we've covered in previous chapters, under attack from the king and his regime, but also in the front line of a serious and profound change in diplomatic policy. The entire future of Europe was at stake, and London was gaining a front row seat into what was actually happening. So where do we start to try and explain this? Well, it's a complicated tale, as there are several strands we need to follow simultaneously, several stories happening at the same time we need to look at. So, for the sake of simplicity, let's start with a tale we've already covered in our last chapter. The upcoming marriage between Catherine of Aragon, now living in London in Durham House, and the new heir to the throne, Prince Henry. That was the excuse for Robert Sherburne to go to Rome in the first place. Oddly enough, the betrothal of Catherine of Aragon and Prince Henry was one hell of a rocky saga. It was never a foregone conclusion. And what London knew at the time and witnessed was just how close it came to never actually happening. So let's go back to early in 1504. Almost 2 years after his brother's death, Prince Henry was stripped of his title of Duke of York. And all the lands and revenues that he had owned now reverted to his father. With that done, he was now invested as Prince of Wales in February 1504. Henry VII had apparently originally planned to have Henry, when he was younger, go off and live like his brother Arthur had done, out in his own lands, learning how to run an estate. But, you know, after the sudden illness and death of his eldest child, he decided he was taking no more chances. King Henry now decided to keep his son close. The new Prince of Wales' household and his council would be an extension of the king's own. Not that young Prince Henry was entirely wet behind the ears. While his formal education still was ongoing, and while he had never seen war, and while he had never even run a landed estate, he had been on display from the moment of his birth, born into the rituals of court life, and above all, Henry, Prince Henry, understood how to play to the crowd. His natural presence and his appetite for the big occasion had been evident from a very early age, which London had seen many times, from when he was 3 years old, riding alone through London upon a horse to be elevated as Duke of York, to his show-stealing escorting of Catherine of Aragon across London, and his making her wedding feast burst out laughing. Henry understood the power of public charisma, and along with this natural showmanship, he was ambitious to take his place on the biggest stage in England, the royal court. Yet, on this stage, he would face an audience who would scrutinise every single aspect of the young man. They'd look closely at how he looked, how he acted, who his companions were, and a whole host of small interactions. And all of this was to allow them assess his potential as the heir and what benefits they could come playing up to him. The new Prince of Wales entered a world where even the smallest gesture he made was political. And it is worth saying that for all of his brashness and showmanship, the side of him that London knew well. He had also been raised an exceptionally pious young man. In this, his life before his elevation to Prince of Wales, which had been dominated by his mother and to his degree his grandmother, we are fairly sure was very strong on that whole religious aspect of his life. His grandmother, Lady Margaret Beaufort, was renowned for her devotional acts. She collected holy relics, she built another collection of books of hours, and she was a patron of many popular religious movements. How much of her ecstatic faith influenced the young prince? Well, we know that Prince Henry would travel around with a bedroll. This was a special document about 5 inches wide and 11 feet long, and when you unrolled it, you would gaze at a parchment roll covered in holy images, in prayers written out in strong Latin, and also with intricate instructions designed to allow the reader give practical devotion to God. It would tell he who owned it to follow the instructions, to kneel, to repeatedly make the sign of the cross, to gaze upon its holy images and icons. You'd do this while repeating endless novenas, endless paternosters, endless credos. It promised that doing this would earn the faithful remission from their time in purgatory. Using this, as Prince Henry seemed to do, was the act of a devoutly faithful Christian, one to whom faith was not an occasional prayer or attending mass, but an active part of your life. So this was a young man entering the royal court then, the king-to-be, flashy, charismatic, intensely, ecstatically faithful and devout, and in all ways utterly under his father's thumb. It was this boy who would be exposed to the tensions and politicking of the royal household and international politics, a world in which he was gently but firmly at first told what he could or could not do. He would come to challenge his father's way of doing things, but that was to come. Now, his arrival in his father's court coincided with the arrival from Rome of the Dean of St. Paul's. And around Prince Henry, negotiations over dispensations needed to marry Catherine of Aragon had been dragging on seamlessly, endlessly. And one of the main reasons that it was taking so long was, simply put, graft. Now, while Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope, had earned a reputation for being the byword for nepotism, the new incumbent, the belligerent and anti-Borgia Julius II, was showing he was not above acting the same way. In fact, he was just as corrupt as the Borgias, it's just that he was corrupt for a different team. Since Julius II had been elevated, he'd started packing the Roman Curia with his relatives from the Tuscan city of Lucca, the Della Rovere dynasty. And this had impacted on the English group trying to get permission for Catherine to marry Henry back in Rome. The Dean of St. Paul's had simply been a messenger from the diplomats who were out there working for Henry VII in the Holy See. And that group was led by a former Borgia favourite, a man called Adriano Castellesi. In order to help the king get what he wanted, Castellesi had been frantically lobbying to ingratiate himself with the new regime in Rome. Castellesi's plan involved basically showering the new Pope's Della Rovere family with sweeteners, either in the form of cash or with honour. It conferred the Order of the Garter on Duke Guido Baldo of Urbino. His glamorous court, you see, acted as a back channel into the Roman Curia. But this glad-handing was simply nowhere near enough corruption to turn the head of the Pope. On the 6th of July, 1504, Pope Julius wrote to Henry VII, and he apologised, saying that he never intended to take so long with sorting out this dispensation, and that any delay was simply due to his desire to, quote, consider the case more maturely, unquote. He promised he would take affairs of matters in England under his, quote, special protection, unquote. Which is a nice way of saying, I want more cash. I mean, not for me, but for the family. The letter went on to say he was delighted that the king had chosen as his cardinal protector the Pope's nephew, Giletto della Rovere. And he took the opportunity in the letter to drop in a few more names whose advancement might further Henry's cause in Rome. Castellesi's name is noticeable because he doesn't mention it once. But amongst the names he did mention was another member of the Pope's extended family, a man called Silvestro Gigli, and Julius heaped praise for his efforts on Henry's behalf. Now, Silvestro Gigli was a name known in London very well. His uncle, a man called Giovanni Gigli, had been born in the Netherlands of Lucianese parents. But as he grew up, he'd moved to England decades before, joining the London branch of the family merchant banking company. Giovanni was cultured, rich, well-read, and had actually been appointed the absentee Bishop of Worcester back in 1497. He had gone on to become the first resident English ambassador at Rome, and when he died, he'd been succeeded as ambassador by Castellesi. Silvestro Gigli was also a London-based Italian merchant financier, and he was a member of King Henry's diplomatic team. He'd been given his uncle's bishopric of Worcester in 1499, and now Silvestro Gigli wanted Castellesi's job. And because his relative Julius II was in power, he saw an opportunity. As the king's two chief diplomats in Rome scrambled for the Pope's favour in the race to obtain this dispensation, their mutual competition was to have rather unexpected side effects and would in time cause ripples that would wash up on London streets. But for now, all it meant was that Pope Julius II had an excuse to kind of blatantly stand there and hint to King Henry VII that that's a really nice engagement you have between your son and that Spanish princess. Be a shame if you were to, you know, not get permission to allow it happen. And all of this right now was making Catherine of Aragon's situation much, much worse. When we left the last chapter, she was stuck in Durham House, but had agreed to be engaged to Henry, which had changed her life a little. But immediately after this, things got very hard for her again. We know in August 1504, she visited the royal court in Greenwich, supposedly to join it, and then fell rather seriously ill. She developed a horrendous cough, a sudden fever, and had shooting pains in her belly. This was not helped when a rather talentless doctor had tried to bleed her and ended up cutting her and finding there was no blood. Yeah. She was supposed to be with Prince Henry as he stayed with his father, but her illness had her return to Durham House. And here, things got worse. While she recovered from her illness, her time in London continued to be stressful. By November in 1504, she wrote two letters back home. And these letters speak of her isolation. And she complained that she had not received a single message from her father, King Ferdinand, quote, for a whole year, unquote. And even worse, rumours were circulating around Richmond Palace and across London that her mother was very ill indeed. And the thing was, these rumours were telling the truth. Queen Isabella of Castilla was very poorly, and she would indeed die soon after. Now, while the death of her mother caused the young princess to be hit with a terrible grief, Isabella's death also had huge political consequences back home. With her passing, you see, the whole issue of Spanish succession suddenly came into very sharp focus. You see, Isabella was Queen of Castilla and had, upon marrying King Ferdinand of Aragon, created a united Spanish kingdom. Now, her death threatened to pull this kingdom apart, and that would wreck Catherine's prospects in the process. You see, the heir to Castilla was Catherine's older sister, Princess Juana, and she was married to the Habsburg ruler of the Low Countries, the son of the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian, a man called Archduke Philip of Burgundy. Philip and Juana's infant son, a boy called Charles of Ghent, was in line to inherit the legacy of both his father's family and his mother's, making him heir to a vast and unprecedented sprawling empire that actually spanned across most of Eastern and Central Europe, included all the Low Countries, Castilia, and unless King Ferdinand could remarry and produce a male heir, the rest of Spain and Spanish Italy. So, hearing the news of Queen Isabella's death, Archduke Philip of Burgundy was determined to lay claim to Castilia on his wife and son's behalf. And why did this now mess up the prospects of marriage for Catherine of Aragon? Well, put simply, a marriage alliance with Aragon was somewhat less glamorous than a marriage alliance with a united Spain. This was a very different and far less attractive proposition to Henry VII. And King Ferdinand knew it. On the day his wife died, he actually wrote a letter to King Henry VII saying, "Look, don't believe anything. What's going to happen is my wife has died, and her dying wish is that I should rule Castilia in the name of my distant daughter. There's no need for the Archduke Philip to claim anything." Yet, as Ferdinand probably knew, it's going to be asked a lot to expect Henry to accept this version of how things would play out. Henry VII instantly saw which way the wind was blowing, and he was no slouch in acting quickly himself. The Habsburg family, with its imperial pretensions, its ownership of the financial and mercantile powerhouse of the Netherlands, and its potential for incredible European expansion through claiming its Spanish claims, looked a much more attractive proposition for somebody for him to marry into his family into. And if all of that wasn't enough, it is worth remembering that the Habsburgs still controlled the Earl of Suffolk, the only real viable claimant to the throne, a genuine Yorkist contender. This factor alone made forging a deal with the Habsburg dynasty much more crucial to the English king. And if this wasn't making things confusing enough, back in Spain, there was tension, hell, there was actual animosity between the Aragonese and the Castilians, and this had been around ages before Isabella's death. In practical terms, this spilt into what was going on in Flanders, and we saw the Aragonese diplomats and the Castilian diplomats at the Burgundian court basically fighting over who should take custody of the Earl of Suffolk, who was still kicking his heels in Aachen and waiting for either the Emperor Maximilian or the Archduke Philip to provide him with funds and men to invade England. Both Ferdinand and Isabella had been trying to get hold of the Earl of Suffolk, because the way they saw it, to make handing him over a bargaining chip in the negotiations with England would work out for him. I mean, offering to hand over the Earl of Suffolk was easy enough to get Henry to drop the demand for 100,000 scudos. What was impeding their schemes was that their Aragonese and Castilian diplomats and agents were competing against one another. As recently as February 1504, they actually came within a fingernail of getting the Earl extradited to the Spanish-controlled territories in Naples. The Earl of Suffolk, however, had been tipped off, and at the last moment he'd fled to the nearby Principality of Guelders, whose Duke was actually linked to the French. Now, what was making all of this really murky was the fact that the person who tipped him off was none other than one of the Spanish ambassadors resident at the court of Philip of Burgundy, a man called Don Juan Manuel. He'd had this stellar record as an outstanding diplomat. He was also a double agent who was actually shifting his allegiance from Ferdinand and Isabella to Archduke Philip, his wife Juana of Castilia, and their infant son Charles. So this explains why he tipped off the Earl of Suffolk to flee from Habsburg lands so as to not to fall to the Aragonese or Castilians, but still be close enough that he would return, cap in hand, to Archduke Philip at a future date. And the reason that I am going off the beaten track to explain all of this intricate Spanish politics in a podcast about London, well, that's simple. Don Manuel's sister was none other than Donna Elvira, the woman who was nominally running Catherine of Aragon's household at Durham House on the Strand. And this was why the situation around Catherine of Aragon had become increasingly complicated. Now, some of these complications were partly self-inflicted. By all accounts, she was isolated. Her English was poor, and she was desperate for support and, dare I say it, affection, which made her vulnerable. This started to cause concern as she had become, quote, very liberal, unquote, with her monies. There were now plenty of people hanging around Durham House who were looking at every opportunity to, quote, strip her of her gold and silver, unquote, to repeat the words of a contemporary report. The keeper of her wardrobe, Juan de Quiro, who watched over the collection of jewels and plate that had formed part of her dowry, complained that pieces would mysteriously go missing, fearing that being pawned to pay for Catherine's lavish lifestyle, or simply given away as gifts for her to buy friends. With its runaway expenditure and its servants involved in open infighting, Catherine's household was utterly out of control, something which the young princess seemed unable to do anything about. Confronted with the stream of reports detailing the breakdown of order in Catherine's household, just before she died, Queen Isabella decided a firm hand was needed to bring everything back into control. You see, after Catherine had been betrothed to Prince Henry, the influence of her duenna, Donna Elvira, had slacked off. But in October 1504, Donna Elvira was back fully in charge of Durham House, and Catherine was placed upon a very short leash. But in this move, we can also see the hand of Henry VII. Behind the scenes, he had clearly been lobbying hard for Donna Elvira's reappointment to head of Durham House. And after Queen Isabella's death that winter, Donna Elvira's ascendancy was not only confirmed, it began to bring Henry benefits. Her close ties to her brother, Don Manuel, meant that Durham House was now a useful diplomatic back channel to the Burgundian court and the Habsburgs. So throughout the first half of 1505, King Henry was keeping up appearances with King Ferdinand of Aragon, but these ongoing negotiations with the Pope and the failure of King Ferdinand to pay the huge sum of money to confirm Catherine's engagement and the actions of the wayward young princess had caused the marriage to suddenly seem less attractive. It had even led to a moment where Prince Henry himself had repudiated the engagement. This was done secretly without Catherine being there, and was probably insisted upon by his father. And after it was done, it was kept secret, but it was kept so that if he wanted to end this engagement, he could spin the breakup as his son being willful and youthful, and I have no control over him, and that would allow him to get out of everything. So from London's point of view, this marriage between Prince Henry and Catherine of Aragon was clearly not on the cards. But it also helped expose something else. This entire ongoing situation, the rise of the Habsburgs dynasty, who seemed literally one generation away from becoming the powerhouse of Europe, and who could possibly end up controlling huge parts of Eastern Europe, the Lowlands and Spain, and this would have made them huge political players, you can see that Henry VII was able to keep up with them. And how he did so and how he showed his power was being entirely facilitated by people living in London. And like, say, Henry V, who earned his international reputation in battle, or Henry II, who earned his international reputation in the amount of land he owned, Henry VII's international reputation came from one thing only: cash. And his ability to get cash to people across Europe. So right now, unbeknownst to King Ferdinand, Henry had already started making new overtures to the Habsburgs. He was using Catherine and a fractured household to do so, utilizing contacts there to backdoor to Philip in the Low Countries. Henry VII was focused on this so as to hunt down and capture the Earl of Suffolk. English agents out of Calais and over in the Netherlands were ceaselessly trying to get him handed over to them. And to aid them, Henry was supplying them with huge sums of cash to help them do this. And one of the men from whom they received funds was a banker, originally from Bologna, called Ludovico della Feva. Now, Ludovico was not just some Italian known to Henry. Of the cluster of Italian merchant bankers living in London and based at the royal court, who, quote, never stopped giving the king advices, unquote, della Feva had emerged as the king's preferred broker. For years, he'd been the head of the London branch of the Medici Bank. And then, when the Medicis collapsed, he now led the English operation of one of the firms that had stepped in to fill their vacuum, the Florentine Bank of the Frescobaldi. Della Feva, while he'd been living in London, had been involved in the usual trade these Italian merchant bankers were normally involved in, the importation of fine Italian silks, satins and damasks, and he'd also dealt in gold and hard bullion. But on top of all of this, he'd gained Henry's respect through his knowledge of the world's financial markets. He offered the king business opportunities. He invested large sums of money on the international currency markets for him, and he took delivery of huge chests filled with coins, which allowed him to prepare bankers' drafts, which could be cashed in at the other offices of the Frescobaldi Bank across Europe. And the Frescobaldi link to the royal family was deep. In 1502, Girolamo Frescobaldi, Del Feva's boss in the bank's Bruges headquarters, had overseen Henry's £10,000 payment to the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian. Indeed, he'd been the only banker willing or able to arrange the transfer of such a large amount of money. The Frescobaldi Bank in London and the Low Countries was incredibly Anglophile. The English paid them well and were amidst their best customers, and this had some interesting small side effects. For example, in 1503, the head of the Florentine branch, Francesco Frescobaldi, welcomed an 18-year-old London boy into his household to apprentice him up as a clerk in this powerhouse of international finance. That 18-year-old boy was called Thomas Cromwell. But gazing at royal records, we see payments to Ludovico della Favera all through Henry's account. He acted like a regular member of the court, submitting expenses to the king's chamber, for all the world like one of Henry's regular privy chamber staff. Della Favera, it's clear, had the king's full confidence. And not only did he handle funds from the king's massive French pension, but he oversaw payments to Henry's spies and key intelligence officers abroad. Della Feva was not just an Italian banker living in London. He was one of the vital cogs that kept Henry's information network ticking over. He was a person who made sure they were liberally supplied with cash. However, by 1505, this formidable operation had drawn blank when it came to capturing Suffolk. Henry's men roamed throughout Flanders, bankrolled by the king, but nobody could provide the breakthrough that Henry so desperately wanted. Now, bribing royalty had been an integral part of Henry's strategy, especially since the examples he learned with Perkin Warbeck. As Henry watched the shifting currents of European politics, he saw that several European powerhouses, the Emperor Maximilian, King Ferdinand of Aragon, and Louis VII of France, were all conducting incredibly expensive foreign wars. They were desperately in need of cash. This was a weakness he could exploit. in April 1505. The treasurer of Henry's chamber, a man called John Heron, recorded an incredible transaction. In exchange for, quote, certain writings, unquote, or a secret understanding between Henry and the Archduke Philip, the king ordered delivery of £108,000 to his ambassadors, processed very probably by letters of credit supplied by Ludovico della Favor. This is a staggering amount of money. It equated to Henry's entire ordinary annual income. In simple terms, right now, no other monarch in Europe could produce such quantities of hard cash. And this was being done to serve a dual purpose for King Henry. As well as trying to pay for the delivery of Suffolk, Henry was also simply buying himself a seat at the high table of Europe. Archduke Philip was now styling himself King of Castilia, and by paying him such a staggering amount of cash, Henry VII was clearly making moves to place England as a crucial ally of this new political order. Yet we're just going to stop for a second and ask a question. Even though we know King Henry VII is rich, how the hell did he get his hands on that much liquidity? This was an eye-wateringly large sum of cash. We know Henry VII was receiving a substantial French pension paid by the French, so he didn't attack them, and it was paid every year. And we also know that the proceeds of his financial aid, the funds granted to him by Parliament in previous years, were siphoned directly into his household accounts. And we also know, as we covered it last chapter, he had his new zealous financial secret police with Edmund Dudley on their head, starting their drive to enforce and collect on all financial bonds across England. But there was another source of income too, one that is almost completely unnoticed. Henry VII was engaged in an illegal trade, a daring, somewhat criminal enterprise, a deal that would bound England closer to the Habsburgs, and which Ludovico della Favor helped organize. The King of England was up to his neck in the smuggling of alum. What the hell is alum? Well, potassium alum had long been seen as a precious substance for its medicinal and cosmetic purposes. But by the late Middle Ages, it was being used on an industrial scale in the textile industry of Northern Europe as a dye fixer. This made it simply indispensable to the wool and cloth trades of England and the Low Countries. And this was the principal industry of both regions and the backbone to all merchanting and beyond the entire mercantile wealth of England and the Low Countries. It was, in short, a mineral without which the economies of those nations would grind to a halt, and therefore dealing in alum was always going to be profitable. So around the start of the 16th century, alum could be found easily over the eastern Mediterranean, but that was all controlled by the Ottomans, who were Muslims. In Western Europe, there was only one main source of it, the papal-owned mine complex of Tolfa, near Rome, where massive deposits of high-grade alum had been discovered back in 1462. To Rome's popes, the mine in Tolfa was literally a gift from God. Profits, they decreed, from this alum were to be designated to be channeled into the funds to pay for ongoing crusades, which was a catch-all term for the papal slush fund. And as such, for every single pope since then, the profits from Tolfa had to be protected and maximized. So in order to exploit this new resource to the full, the papacy decided that trade in alum from Tolfa had to be a monopoly. And they placed in charge of the monopoly a succession of banking firms, the first of which was the Medici. But by 1501, it had been taken over by the Sienese bank of Agostino Cigni, who had a reputation of being the single most ruthless businessman in Italy. It was crucial that the monopoly be maintained. And the best way to do that was to instantly restrict the supply of alum and keep prices high. To facilitate this, the Bank of Chigny, with full papal support, basically created an alum cartel. Expensive alum was now sold to the vast Netherlands cloth industry at a high price, allowing staggering profits to line the Pope's coffers. And to further protect this God-given cash cow, the Vatican backed up this rigged market with a full range of spiritual threats and punishments. Papal bulls promised excommunication, anathema, and perpetual condemnation on anyone who would trade alum illegally with the infidel Ottoman Muslims. In other words, if you tried to buy alum from anywhere except Tolfa, the church would come down on you real hard. Now, in the Low Countries of the Netherlands and Flanders, these controls had been roughly in place for 2 decades when Pope Julius II arrived on the scene in late 1503. And he needed income to fund his plans to restore papal power in central Italy. So he immediately ramped up the price of papal alum by limiting supply even more. This combination of incredibly high prices and scarcity hit the region hard. The ensuing economic slump in textile trade had actually caused outbreaks of violence in massive commercial centres like Bruges and Antwerp. And that threatened and was threatening to escalate into something much bigger. The Emperor Maximilian and his son Philip were very worried indeed, and they had gathered a group of merchants from Bruges to explore possible solutions to this crisis. And these merchants were savvy. There was, they said, only one way out of it. You had to ignore all the threats from the papacy. We had to increase our supply of illegal alum from the Eastern Mediterranean. Maximilian and Philip actually agreed to this, but, you know, there was a problem. As the Holy Roman Emperor, Maximilian could hardly be seen to flout papal decrees openly. But, said the merchant, there is another option. If the alum could be sold to England, there it could be effectively laundered to disguise its origin, and then they could sell it to us in the Low Countries. The middleman for this massive illegal trade would be the Frescobaldi Bank, whose European dominance and reach made it ideal, and whose representative in England was Henry's favoured broker, Ludovico della Favor. Now, Henry, of course, like a good Christian king, had, over the previous few years, made it very clear he was always on the side of the Pope. When Pope Julius was elected in 1503, it sent him gifts, and as we've just seen, he was indulging Julian's nepotism, lavishing favour and high office on his friends and relatives. He also appeared to act very loyal to the Vatican's alum monopoly. He had paid for a contract with the Pope's principal monopolist, Agostino Cigli, who imported substantial quantities of the minerals into London, and whose representative, an Italian called Francesco Tomasi, who maintained a high-profile house in Austin Friars, was known across London as Mr. Alum. So on paper, Henry VII would never be involved in this conniving plan from a bunch of merchants in Bruges to deal in illegal alum, right? Don't believe it. Henry was up to his neck in the illegal alum racket. In fact, he seems to have been involved in it, at least aware of its potential, all the way at the start of his reign. You see, all the way back in February 1486, a merchant from Genoa who was trading in London, a guy called Giovanni de Negrioni, heard a whisper of a Spanish ship that was en route to the Low Countries with an illegal consignment of alum. And hearing this news, he had hired a crew of English pirates who had attacked the ship in the English Channel, boarded it, killed several of his crew, and then towed it into port in England. Once it got there, Negroni flourished this piece of paper, which was papal legislation, which banned illicit alum imports, and said he intended to appropriate the cargo on behalf of the Pope himself, and no doubt taking a very healthy cut of the profits for himself. And it's at this point, back in 1486, that a mysterious figure, a, quote, certain Florentine merchant, unquote, intervened with the king. This merchant told the king that there were no laws in England against the free trade in alum. And what Negroni had done, capturing a ship by force without his permission, was wrong. This became a protracted legal case that turned into an international incident. Henry explained to the rather angry Pope that as much as he wanted to do right by the Apostolic See, his hands were tied. The law of the land said you can't engage in piracy. Negroni and the Pope lost the case, and Henry probably was paid a large chunk of the alum proceeds by the grateful merchant. Now, who this certain Florentine merchant was, we don't know. Although, it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility to suggest that it could have been Della Fava himself. Whatever the case, now nearly 20 years later, in 1504, Della Fava was the man who came to Henry with the details of the new Frescobaldi scheme. And the king knew precisely what this would entail. And by all accounts, his eyes lit up. The scheme was simple, and the potential profit margins were enormous. Through Della Fava, Henry loaned capital to the Frescobaldi people and licensed them some ships, including his own Great Carax, the Sovereign, and the Regent, both of whom he ordered to be overhauled in preparation for a rather exciting and clandestine journey. Now registered as Frescobaldi ships, these English ships sailed to the Muslim-dominated Eastern Mediterranean, there to buy alum, and they did from Anatolia, from the Greek islands, from Thrace. Then, having done so, they sailed back. In London, Della Fava then broke a deal onwards to the Low Countries. For all the parties involved, except the Pope, it was a win-win situation. Despite the huge reimportation charges and the massive customs duties claimed by Henry, the Frescobaldis could still get a hell of a price for the alum. And for the people in the Low Countries, it was still much cheaper than the stuff that was coming from Tolfa. For Henry, this increased flow of cheaper alum actually placated his London merchants and drapers and allowed him further control over the alum supply and therefore the entire textile industry of England. And in the process, he increased his revenues. All he had to do was supply money to Della Fava and then turn a blind eye. And at Henry's shoulder, helping him broker these deals, was Edmund Dudley, whose intimate knowledge of London's customs and excise duties made him invaluable. Henry simply made a colossal fortune out of this racket. In one opening deal, the alum was snapped up by desperate cloth makers in England and the Low Countries and earned him a cool £8,666, 13 shillings and 4 pence. Another alum shipment, which was brokered by King Henry, Edmund Dudley and Della Fava, became the biggest single mercantile deal of his entire reign. It was worth £15,166, 13 shillings, and 4 pence. This, for me, is the true faith of Henry VII towards the end of his reign. He was basically running a smuggling racket in plain sight and yet hidden from all. He was able to conduct what was the largest smuggling ring in Europe and to use the profits to grease the wheels of international diplomacy, which gained him a seat at the high table of European politics, allowed him to get all up in the business of Spain and the Low Countries, to work against his enemies abroad while keeping an eye on the dynastic ambition of his son, and do all of this while simply earning more money. He was on a roll. But he had a problem. Henry was spending all this cash into getting to Archduke Philip's good graces. But think about it. From Archduke Philip's point of view, Why the hell should he hand over the Earl of Suffolk? I mean, this was his Yorkist cash cow. He could play this game for years and years, gaining more and more cash from the English throne, and using that to fund his wars. And so, even though the gambit was working out, there were still problems. Despite this illegal trade he was doing, despite helping out Philip and the Habsburgs, and decreasing political tension for them in Bruges and Antwerp, he still couldn't get Philip to do exactly what he wanted. And he was still having to negotiate a possible alliance with King Ferdinand over in Aragon. And meanwhile, Pope Julius II was very aware of what the English and the Burgundians were doing. And he was bloody furious. And he wanted revenge. And at this, we're going to put a pause into it, because there's a lot more to go on. This is only part one of the Spanish Gambit. Coming soon, part two of the story. How a bit of unexpected luck was to change Henry VII's future forever. And also, what the hell did the Pope do to get revenge? That's all coming up in the next issue. Sorry for being a bit late this week, just had a lot on. And next week we'll be back to a normal schedule, as I'll carry on with part two of the Spanish Gambit. This is Saul, hoping you are all well and good. And yeah, if you want for any questions, please ask. All right, I'm back again next week. See you then. Bye.